Scott's classic. It's a tearjerker, too. Bob Carlyle and Butterfly Kisses. 10 minutes after the hour on a winsome Wednesday morning here along the Broken Road. David Allen Punt is with us, and so is Doug Greenwald. Well, Doug, how do they say hello in Hebrew?
That I don't know, but typically okay. They'll greet you with shalom.
Shalom. Well, that's coming and going, shalom, huh?
Well, shalom is more going, okay. And singular shalom is more coming.
All righty. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times and the Executive Director thereof, just back from kind of just off the boat, or just off the airplane in this case. And I'm wondering what you found over there, what kind of stories you bring back with you. How was the trip overall?
The trip went very, very well. We had 29 on the bus this time, and really great chemistry, and we established that chemistry quickly amongst the people. It was a lot of fun, a lot of repartee, a lot of back and forth on our buses and in our days, and rapidly the group became community, and they were just really sad to see it end after 2 weeks. It's amazing when you spend 2 weeks together, all your waking hours, how fast community can unfold.
Now, I suspect that such tours attract some very knowledgeable people, too, people who have been there before, who have studied or at least prepared themselves for this trip. Do you ever find yourself learning from your tour people?
No offense to the tour people, but rarely. Mm-hmm. What does happen, since we teach with three teachers on these unique Preserving Bible Times, Life and Land of Israel study programs, you do learn things from the other teachers.
Ah.
And that certainly was true again this year. And that's one of the things that's an absolute joy for me, is to have two other teachers on the trip. It's a three-voice trip, and always learn something from the other two voices. And perhaps they might learn a thing or two from my reflections as well. But that's why I'm a big fan of not even stereo. When there are three voices, we can't call that triario, but you get the idea.
Hard to say. Yeah, you could.
Maybe we'll call that surround sound.
There you go. That would be good. Now, for those listening who don't know Doug is with Preserving Bible Times. It's a ministry based near Washington, D.C., and really what he does is reconstitutes the first century Hebrew context of Scripture so that when you read it, it just jumps off the page at you. You see new things there that were there all the time, but have gone right by us because we're not acquainted with that context. We don't read it or hear it the same way that first century audience would have. And so he doesn't lead tours, although he does, just back from one, but he visits churches, and he conducts Bible Live weekends at churches all across the country, at which he teaches the context of the first century. So you've done this so thoroughly. Are there new things for you to learn about first century context yet when you go over there? Do your tours contribute to that?
Absolutely. Those that teach learn, and those that listen to other teachers learn. That's one of the exciting parts of these. They're really not tours. They're more study programs, contextual immersion experiences as we go. But yes, particularly when you go to new places. This particular year, we added Azekah, or as the Hebrews might say it, Azekah. And that's down in the Hula Valley, the Elah Valley, excuse me. And that's where David and Goliath fared off. And I've always been in that valley for teaching. But more down where the creek is and the stones, and you look up and see this big mountain, Azekah, where there was a city on top of it, where the Philistines supposedly gathered around Azekah. And across the valley at the hill of Sukkot is where the Israelites gathered. But this time we took the bus way up the hill of Azekah and got up to the top and looked over the valley on a spectacular afternoon. The sun was sort of setting late afternoon in the west, and we were looking east. The lighting was brilliant, just a few white clouds in the sky. You could look across the valley, you could envision the whole scene, and you could even see where these gentle, humble hills of Judea end. They're called the Shvelah. and the hill country of Judea opens up, and we get, with such a clear day, we could even see the outskirts of Bethlehem on the central ridge in the Judean hills. It was just a spectacular sight and view. And so one of the things I like to do on every trip is just add in a couple of three new sites, different sites each trip. And that keeps it fresh for me, and always gives me something to look forward to. And you discover new visual treats as well as learning treats as well when you factor these into your program.
Do you ever see repeat tour members? Where there's usually a new group every time.
No, we had some repeats on this one. Not that many. I think three maybe. But personally, if you asked me, what's the ideal way to absorb Israel? I would say take at least four trips to Israel. To give you an example, the first time I went, I had 22 pages of single space notes. The second time I went, I had 11 pages of single space notes. The third time, I had 5 pages. And this time, I just was making some mental observations in my own mind. And you just can't absorb everything on one trip. And you learn things, as you listen to different voices if you go back again. And you need time to reflect and integrate what you've seen before. And so it almost never happens. But I do have one friend who has been 13 times and claims continues to learn new things.
Well, there's lots of geography there. I mean, it's not a huge place by Western standards, American standards, but it's such a rich history. Do you get the feeling that you're back in the first century there? Is there a place you can go in Israel where you can say, aha, this is what it looked like when Jesus was here?
I would say, by and large, except for maybe the trees, the topography is still the same. Now, you have to get out of the cities, of course, to appreciate that. But when we were down south around Beersheba, driving to Arad on our way to the Dead Sea, I mean, it looked just the same as it did in the first century. Some of the roads you go down in the south in the Judean wilderness, absolutely, you get that feeling. You can go to the Galilee, and they go up on top of the Arbel Cliffs, which is the highest point there. And you can look down on the international highway and you can feel exactly like you would in the first century. And because you're up high and you can see the whole Sea of Galilee in view at one time, and there's not a lot of other than Tiberias city development still around the Sea of Galilee, it still seems pristine. When we were on the Mount of Beatitudes, I don't like to go on the grounds per se. We sneak outside the fence. I shouldn't say sneak. We're allowed to do this. We go outside the fence and find some rocks, big black basalt volcanic rocks on the hillside of the Mount of Beatitudes. And we just sit our group down there. And I teach the Beatitudes on that site. And then we do some quiet time reflection. And as we were looking south, the sun came out. The mustard plants with their yellow blossoms were all over the hillside. Everything was lush green from the winter rains. You could just envision being part of the crowd of 4,000 or 5,000 people who would listen to Jesus. And by the way, listening to Jesus, around the Mount of Beatitudes, they're in this bowl that the Sea of Galilee sits in, there are some concave, they're not valleys, but just some concave cutouts in the side of the hill. And this black basalt is volcanic, and it has a very high metallic content, which means it reflects sound. And so there actually you can demonstrate and prove how Jesus could talk to 4,000 or 5,000 people.
You know, I was just going to ask you that. That's interesting. You would zero in on that. So it's a kind of a natural amphitheater effect there.
Very much so. The first time in 88 when we were in Israel, we had 48 people on the bus. And that trip was led by Jim Martin. And he got out of the bus and he stood on the gravel seashore of the Sea of Galilee, and he told all 48 of us to go up this hillside and spread out at 15-foot intervals. So, you know, 40, let's call it 50 people times 15 feet. That's a 750-foot linear mm-hmm. line of people going up the hillside. And he was on the in the gravel beach there, and he said, if you can hear me now, raise your hand. And every hand went up.
Wow.
So, you know, it's interesting. We wonder, yeah, right, he spoke and 5,000 people heard him. No, it literally can happen that mm-hmm. way. You just have to understand the hillside. You have to understand the volcanic rock. You have to understand its properties. And a couple decades ago, a sound crew came up out from New York City and actually documented that this indeed can happen. So, well, yeah, those are the kind of surprises you have.
Yeah.
Another surprise that just takes people's breath away is when we're up on the Mount Carmel Ridge and we're overlooking the Jezreel Valley, the Valley of Armageddon, and I point across the valley to the Chalk Ridge of Nazareth and point that out to people and then say, now think about this. Jesus grew up every day overlooking the Valley of Armageddon. The Prince of Peace grew up every day overlooking the valley where Revelation says one day representatives from all the armies in the world will be gathered. And, you know, until you walk the land, you will never understand, never fathom those kind of juxtapositions that the geography offers you. Now, I don't care if you read your Bible 1,000 times. And so that's what's exciting, is you begin to realize how small this land is, although it's very diverse, the proximity of one thing to another, the sight lines that you have from one text and passage to another as Jesus teaches and moves in his ministry, and it's just one aha moment after another.
Now, a while ago you mentioned except for the trees. What did you mean by that?
Well, the foliage is very, very different now in Israel. There were a lot more oaks in Israel, not the towering oaks that we would know. They're more of a scrub oak. But when the Ottomans came into this land, and like in the 630 ADs, it took them a while, but they came up with a very creative way to raise tax money. And that was to tax your property by the number of trees you had on it. And within about 30 years, it sort of defoliated the country.
Governments have just inventive ways of destroying things.
Yeah, and so in 48, you know, when Israel got back into the land here, they started a very, very aggressive deforestation program, which was focused on pine trees. And so now you see a lot more pine trees in Israel than you do the scrub oaks of biblical times.
Interesting. You've come back to a busy schedule. I know you're headed up to our neck of the woods here later this month. We're greatly looking forward to that. Doug, coming up to the Brainerd, Minnesota area, and doing actually two seminars, so we're excited for that and looking forward to the visit. Well, of course, you've been doing that so long now. Is it easy to switch gears from tour guide in Israel back to seminar guy?
It's the same thing. Same content, same information. It's just that the site changes. You know, we're going to do, for one of the two seminars up in the Baxter Brainerd, Minnesota area, it's going to be The Last Days of Jesus, The Greatest Story Never Completely Told. Mm-hmm. Well, I just came back from walking to Villa Dolorosa and talking about the last hours and days of Jesus. So, I mean, it's perfectly natural. In fact, you can almost say I'm primed, I'm pumped, I'm ready, I'm renewed with even more insights for that John 11 through the end of John material, which we will be sharing at Lakewood Evangelical Free Church in about 3 weeks.
Yeah, 3 weeks.
Yep, wow.
Yep. Things are underway. We're getting ready for you, and greatly looking forward to it. What's on tap for you after that?
Well, would you mind if we went back to Israel for a moment?
No, that's fine. Let's do that.
And sort of connect with some dots here with current events?
Sure.
One of the things I learned, I didn't know this before, but talking with our Israeli guide and one of our other teachers, is that there's a very different view of land whether you're a Shiite or a Sunni Muslim. And that makes the Sunni-Shiite struggle really an important one. For example, the Sunnis believe that the territorial reach of Islam from a geography control point of view, should not exceed that which Muhammad specified or where he went, okay? The Shiites reject that viewpoint and say that wherever Islam goes, they're entitled to take control of the real estate. So the Shiite view of things is always aggressive, always expansive. The Sunni view of things is we're not entitled to go any further in our geographic reach than where Muhammad has already taken Islam. So you see what the implication of that is for Israel?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah, and so I did not appreciate the Sunni-Shiite struggle and what it means. There's another aspect of Islam that both sides embrace, and that is wherever Islam has reached in history, that is, controlled some aspect of geography, it's their land and they're entitled to have it back, even if they don't control it now. And so I was reminded of Osama bin Laden's obsession with southern Spain.
Hmm.
Because in the Moorish era, southern Spain was controlled by Islam, and then they were driven out. So
like 700 years, yeah.
Yeah, they're entitled to have southern Spain back. Wherever Islam has gone at some point in history and been dislodged, they are not only entitled, almost mandated to try to recontrol that land again. Well, the Ottoman Empire was in Israel from 630 AD to well into the end of the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they're entitled to have it back.
Mm.
The fact that the Israelites predated them means nothing. There was a time when we controlled this land, therefore we're entitled to have it back. And I heard about a conference that took place in New York City where the thesis was Columbus was not the first person to discover the United States. A Muslim was, an Islamist. And therefore, you get the idea here? We're entitled to control the United States. So there's some interesting stuff going on out there from a worldview / theology perspective in Islam that has enormous implications for current events.
Indeed.
Well, did you see the speech?
I did. I thought it was extremely well done, very forcefully made, and you get the sense of the Jewish worldview now. Never, ever again. I don't think we comprehend that. And if you listened carefully, well, you didn't have to listen carefully, but connecting the dots, Netanyahu said, you can never, ever trust Iran.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of alluded to it. He said it many, many times, different ways. I never sort of explicitly said it. But you want to know the Israeli viewpoint? It's exactly that. Whatever agreement you sign with Iran is going to be meaningless to Iran. Their underlying objectives allow them to do whatever they want to do whenever they want to do it, and these agreements are just convenient political things to do to maybe try to make it easier and quicker, but the underlying objective never, ever goes away. And so their viewpoint of a deal with Iran is it's a meaningless piece of paper. Their vision for how they see Israel or don't see Israel hasn't changed one iota. Their purpose towards Israel has not changed one iota. And we in the West need to wake up and just not be naive that we think we can negotiate the worldview of the Shiite Iranians away. And so it's a sobering thought.
Did you have conversations with other Israelis while you were there about this?
Not that many, no, but you've heard me say before, whenever three Jews get together, there are always four opinions. And so if you ask what's the tenor or tone of Israel for what not Netanyahu was going to do before he did it and what they now think after he's done it, there'll be 1,000 voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. I watched the speech, and I watched it with Western eyes and watched it with my own eyes and in my own context and from where I sit in the middle of the frozen north. But afterwards, I started thinking a little bit, too, about what does the common, ordinary, everyday Israeli think? What do they think when because they live that? They are on the front line. All of a sudden, it's not just a kind of an academic exercise like it is for me. You know, that's going to happen a long ways away. But when Netanyahu said, "We're only the first victim," they're going to come for you next, just like all the other, you know, leaders that tried to dominate the world. And I think one of the other things that Netanyahu said too was that. There are at least two major groups, radical Islam and Iran, and the biggest disagreement they have now is who is going to rule in this kingdom after they mass all their power. I mean, that's the only thing that's keeping them from being totally unified. They just can't figure out who's going to end up with all the goodies.
You'd think we'd give. The prime minister some credit for having been there, lived the life there, seen the lay of the land there, understanding the cultures. But naivete seems to be an apt description for our leadership, for all of us. But it seems to me there you got to give him some credence, some credibility for being who he is, and for knowing the life over there. So.
Yeah, the classic line we've used on this program over the years: nothing has meaning without a context.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just wonder: does the State Department and that whole negotiating crew truly understand the context of what Iran is all about and their intentions? And I mean, I want to use the word naive, but maybe they're wiser than I think. I mean, we'll see. But
as a person that I listen to every once in a while, it said the other day, Obama doesn't consider himself to be a failure. He considers everything he's tried and accomplished to be a success, and the programs are not working, and liberal programs don't work, but. As if from their perspective, they're just, you know, it's a small step towards the final result. So they see themselves as a success.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't like venturing into politics too much, but I think Obama has had so many failures on the international stage that he's desperate for something he can claim as a success because he's got this preoccupation with his legacy. And I just hope the preoccupation with his legacy just won't allow him to sign any deal just to say he's done a deal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
We're talking with Doug Greenwald, Executive Director and Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times. I would like to recommend that you visit the website. It's a gorgeous website. It's only a couple months old, and it's loaded with photos from both Doug's Israel trips and trips to Italy. I keep forgetting... What you call? I keep thinking of them as Pauline Studies tours.
Well, it's Paul's Roman World.
Paul's Roman World. When's the next one?
End of May, mm-hmm. And so in about 30 days, I need to refocus and get ready for our third trip to Italy, and that's truly exciting because people, for one reason or another, have a much better understanding of Israel, even though there's a ton more to understand. But relatively speaking, they have a better understanding of Israel in the context of Israel than they do of Paul's Roman World. And so, you know, we take people to Israel, they come with 30% understanding and they leave with 80% understanding. We take people to Paul's Roman World and they arrive with a 3% understanding and leave with a 60% understanding. So there's actually more backfilling. There's more understanding. There's more aha moments. There's more, I never knew that. I never thought about that. From Paul's Roman World than there is from the Gospels and the Life and Land of Jesus teaching program in Israel. And I think if you think about it, that's because we're probably exposed to the Gospels and Jesus and his encounters and teaching much more than we are the Pauline side of life. And we realize that the world of the Gospels is very different from ours. And we somehow think, well, the Pauline world is Gentile, it's Western, it must be very much like ours. And boy, is that a false assumption. And so it's really sort of, you almost do relatively more learning and aha moments and lights go on the Paul's Roman World program than we do on the Life and Land of Jesus program in Israel.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any seats available on that tour for May, or are you full up?
We're in the countdown here. I think we have a week left, and that even may require $100 a late payment, because normally we button that trip up 90 days before we go. But we could probably squeeze two or three people in within the next several days, if need be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good.
By the way, the first week we were in Israel, it was unseasonably cool. Normally it isn't. Normally we're dealing with 65, 70 degree days, but we had some 55 degree days, and we actually had a cold spell come through for about 48 hours, and they got 10 inches of snow in the northern part of the country on the Golan Heights, which meant that Mount Hermon, was totally covered in white. Even Israeli guide said, wow, almost never have that experience, never have that view and sight. And so it was unusually spectacular to be up in the northern part of the country for a couple of days. And up on the Golan Heights, where there were 8 to 10 inches of snow, there were cars all over parked on the side of the road. It's like half of southern Israel, when they heard that there were 10 inches of snow on the Golan Heights, all came up north and parked on the side of the road and got out of the car with their kids and started running through the snow, started making snowmen, starting to have snowball fights. And that was for mile after mile after mile after mile. Our bus could hardly get through the roads because people were just parking on the edge on both sides. But it was really fun to see the delight that the Israelis had when snow falls on their country, because they almost never see it.
See, David, we're so lucky we get to see that every day up here.
Well, yeah.
Doug, thanks so much. Appreciate the time this morning. Good to have you back safely. And we'll look forward to next Wednesday, okay?
Okay, guys.
Take care.
Good to be back. Good to be with you again.
Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times.